From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, neuroscientist Dean Burnett explains how our brains alter our memories, how motion sickness is caused by the brain picking up on contradictory signals, and just how short our short-term memory really is.
Short-term memory is 30 seconds to a minute. Anything longer than that tends to actually now be officially a long-term memory.
Burnett's new book is called Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. And we hear from comic and comedy writer Ali Wong. She recorded her Netflix special, Baby Cobra, when she was 7.5 months pregnant. In that comedy special, she manages to talk about a very painful subject, her earlier miscarriage.
There's all sorts of blame that I think women put on themselves. And I do want other women to know that I had one, and that if you have had one too, you're not a freak for having one, and that it is very common.
That's coming up on Fresh Air. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. People often think of the brain as being like a computer, but according to my guest, neuroscientist Dean Burnett, that's only true if you imagine a computer that decided some information in its memory was more important than other information for reasons that were never made clear. Or a computer that filed information in a manner that didn't make any logical sense. Or a computer that kept opening your more personal and embarrassing files without being asked. Burnett is the author of the new book, Idiot Brain, What Your Head is Really Up To. It focuses on some of the more illogical behaviors the brain produces. He lives in Wales, where he's based at Cardiff University's Center for Medical Education and teaches in the psychiatry department. He writes the science blog, Brain Flapping, for the British newspaper, The Guardian. Dean Burnett, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
So in that analogy that you make between the brain and a computer, you say your brain would be like a computer that decided it didn't really like the information you'd stored, so the computer altered it for you to suit your purposes, to suit your preferences. And you say your memory is egotistical, that the brain tweaks and adjusts the information it stores to make you look better. What's an example of what you mean there?
Well, I think the classic example you see is like someone claiming they caught a fish this big, holding their arms out. And the obvious joke is that they didn't really. That's actually, you know, just an exaggeration. But a lot of people think that's just someone lying to try and look better. But a lot of research suggests that we actually, whenever we remember something, we will tend to embellish, if we're telling someone about it, we'll embellish it slightly to make us look a bit better, or we'll make it a bit more impressive as a story. But every time you do that, you know, the memory itself it's got a good chance of it itself being edited, it's being adjusted. So the actual underlying memory is replaced by this updated version that you have created to convey sort of something which makes you look better. And that seems to be happening constantly, in that we think back on things and we sort of interpret them in different ways to make us feel better about ourselves, make us feel more accomplished, more involved, more capable, and more important than we actually were. Because our memory is the only record of it that often goes unnoticed.
In writing about memory, you write about the difference between short-term memory and long-term memory. And short-term memory really doesn't hold very much. I mean, from how you describe it, it holds less than I even thought.
Yeah, that's a sort of one of those mainstream ideas of how memory is structured and works, which is not quite correct, in that short-term memory, you see a lot of films and like TV shows, they sort of portray short-term memory as something from an hour ago or like that same day. Whereas actually short-term memory is 30 seconds to a minute. Anything longer than that tends to actually now be officially a long-term memory, because it takes the brain...
Whoa. Yeah. Anything longer than a minute is officially long-term memory?
Essentially, yes.
That means my long-term memory is worse than I thought.
Yeah, it's a strange... because short-term memory is essentially patterns of activity in place like the frontal cortex. It's like a firework display, or like I liken it to writing a shopping list in the foam on your coffee. You can sort of do it, and it's something it'll stay legible for a minute, but just generally quickly it'll fade away. Whereas a long-term memory actually is like the neurons and the brain cells connecting together to form a new memory, but that takes time. That takes like 30 seconds to a minute for that to actually be achieved and the storage to actually happen. So in the interim, we have this short-term memory, which is sort of holding a pattern just in place, waiting for either the memory to be formed or for the information to be replaced. And you obviously know that happens a lot, because when you sort of get up to go to the kitchen to get something, and then when you get there, you think, why am I in here now? And then you can't remember why you came in the first place. All you know is that you're there now. And that's like an example of a short-term memory being sort of lost rather than it's stored, despite the fact that you actually have acted on it already.
So I found this very interesting. You say in your book that there's evidence to suggest that nearly everything we experience is stored in long-term memory in some form. And here's why I find that interesting. This is the kind of thing that happens to me a lot. Like, one of our producers will come up to me and say, do you know that blah, 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 blah? And then I'll say, in all honesty, that sounds familiar. I don't know if I know that. And as my producer starts explaining, I slowly start to remember that, yeah, I did know that. And I realize that I once knew this thing, then I'd forgotten it. But there's still some kind of vague imprint of that memory in my mind. And the more I hear about it, the more the memory starts to resurface. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a lot of evidence to suggest that there is different types of memory, something called familiarity, and the difference between that and recall. Because with familiarity, it's like you say, you know something, but you don't have any more information than that. All you know is that this has been encountered previously.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes. Again, like using the computer analogy, if you do a Google search and then some things pop up and some of them are like already purple, it's, oh, I've been to that site before. You don't know what that site has on it. You don't know what it was for. It could be something dodgy. Maybe you were drunk at the time. I don't know. But you just know that you've been there before. But it's when you actually open like the file or open the store that you actually understand what's going on in there. So it's the same with like the name thing again, or like when you meet someone and they have a very familiar face, you think, I know this person. I know, why do I know them? And then they'll tell you some details and they'll fill in a few more things. And they'll say something when you go, oh yes, that's why. Because at that point there's enough familiarity has occurred. It's sort of reached the threshold, the recall threshold, where it's not just knowing you have the memory. Now the memory itself is actually activated and it all comes flooding back. It's that very strange sensation of like, oh yes, now I remember all that. And it all, look, the actual memory itself is triggered because enough familiarity has happened. So the activity leading to that memory has gone past a certain point and the whole thing is set off. And we have like the vivid experience just coming back to you going, oh yes, I met him here and then we did that. And that was 10 years ago and so on, so on, so on. So there are lots of, you know, the brain has a good sort of rule of thumb for new and old. Like that's a new thing, that's an old thing, that's a new thing, that's an old thing. But when you actually need the detailed information itself, that's when you need to trigger the recall threshold, for want of a better description.
Okay, so the downside for me is I have a lot of memories that I will only remember if somebody tells me that information again, and then it'll start to surface. So on the downside, I've forgotten that memory. But on the positive side, once I hear it the second time, I think I'm more likely to remember it and keep it as a more permanent memory. Am I deluding myself, or is that neurologically probable?
No, that makes perfect sense, because we remember certain things and not other things, and that's sort of a constant problem, because we'd like to remember the things, like if you're revising for a test or an exam, that's the stuff you want to remember. But abstract information, which is just like intangible data, and that isn't something the brain has really evolved to process. It can do it, but it's not its preferred form of information. It's more about experiences and things with a strong emotional attachment. Any emotionally vivid memories, like your first bike, your first date with your partner, your wedding day, these are all things which have strong emotional resonance. So they have a lot more attachments in the brain. Like every single memory has lots of different links to it. So there are lots of different ways to trigger it. So if you have like an old memory which you don't actually haven't really thought about, that's fair enough. It's got a limited amount of connections to make it accessible. But then when you are reminded of it by talking to a person, and you go, oh yes, and then it all comes flooding back. That's a new sensation. Now you associate that memory with this experience of not being able to remember something and then remembering the person and being happy that you remember them. So you're forming lots of new connections to it. So that actually does make perfect sense in that the act of having a sudden vivid recollection would in fact increase the likelihood that the memory will be a bit more resilient from then on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is neurologist Dean Burnett. He's the author of the new book, Idiot Brain, What Your Head Is Really Up To. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is neurologist Dean Burnett, author of the new book, Idiot Brain. He's based at the University of Cardiff Center for Medical Education, and he's a lecturer in psychiatry and writes a blog for The Guardian called Brain Flapping. So it's summertime, which means a lot of people are going on vacation, and a lot of those vacationers are going to be driving, many of them with children in the car. And I think children are especially prone to motion sickness.
Mm-hmm.
You have a very interesting explanation for why we can get motion sickness in a moving vehicle.
Yes, it's one of those things which people, it's such a common thing. I think a lot of people don't give it that much thought. But When you think about it, moving shouldn't make us sick. We move around all the time. We're a very mobile species. So why, you know, why would moving suddenly make us want to throw up? And one theory is, perhaps the most salient theory at the moment, is that it's caused by a sensory confusion in the brain, in that when you're walking, you know, like as humans tend to do a lot, there's a lot of distinct signals being relayed to the brain, like in the like the thalamus, where all the sensory information is put together and sort of, you know, fed to the other parts of the brain. So when you're walking, you've got the sort of the left, right, up, down sort of sensation. You've got the muscular system doing its thing and relaying all the signals to the brain. And you've also got the balance sensors in your ears, like little tiny little tubes full of fluid. And the motion of that fluid tells us where we're going. So like if we're upside down, we can tell. And if we're going fast, we can tell, because this fluid just obeys the laws of physics. And also you've got your eyes, and the world's going past at a certain rate. All these things are sensory information, which is fed into the thalamus area, which integrates all this sensory information together to give us an opinion or give us a view of what's happening in the world around us. So we think, oh, well, I'm moving. This is good. That's what I should be doing. Excellent. All is well. When you're in a vehicle, and vehicles aren't something we've really evolved to deal with, because obviously they're a very, very recent addition to the world, and evolution takes a long time to catch up with anything. So when you're in a vehicle, like a car or a train or a ship especially, you're not actually physically moving. Your body is still. You're sat down, like, so you've got no signals from the muscles saying we are moving right now. The muscles are saying we are stationary. And also your eyes, if you're sitting in a ship, like you're looking at a static environment, so there's no information for the eyes to say we are moving. It's just, no, everything is still. But the fluids in your ears, they obey the laws of physics, and they are sort of rocking around and sloshing because you are actually moving. So what's happening there is the brain's getting mixed messages. It's getting signals from the muscles and the eyes saying we are still, and signals from the balance sensors saying we're in motion. And both of these cannot be correct. There's a sensory mismatch there. And in evolutionary terms, the only thing that can cause a sensory mismatch like that is a neurotoxin or poison. So the brain thinks essentially it's been poisoned. When it's been poisoned, the first thing it does is get rid of the poison, aka throwing up. And as a result, so like as soon as the brain gets confused by anything like that, it says, oh, well, I don't know what to do, so just be sick, just in case. And as a result, we get motion sickness, because the brain's constantly worried about being poisoned.
Oh, that is so incredibly not helpful. Not your explanation, but the sickness.
No, it's inconvenient, to say the least.
So I think it's true that you're more likely to get motion sickness if you're reading in a moving vehicle, not an airplane. This is what I found to be true. Just that queasy feeling. Hmm. I know, like when I was growing up, I could not read in a car. I could not read in a bus, but I could read in a train and I could read in a plane.
That's not like a, is that a Dr. Seuss poem?
No, oh, yes. Yes, it is.
Could you on a plane? Could you in a train?
No, so is there any... I'm assuming that this is a common experience and it's not just me, but perhaps it's just me.
Well, it makes again, given the explanation I provide, that does make perfect sense, because you are... It's not just you're in the vehicle now. When you're reading a book, you are staring at something right in front of you. So you're shutting out a lot of external visual information. Now, when you're in a car, a lot of people don't get motion sickness because the brain can effectively integrate this. But some people just are prone to it. It's just a quirk of development. But you know, in your car, you can look out the window. You can see things going by. You can see the passage and movement itself. So that sort of balances the system. The brain's going, oh, look, things moving. I must be moving. And then sort of calms down the sickness response. But when you're reading, you're looking at sort of a small static square, and you know, the external information which would say you're moving, that's shut out even more than it would otherwise be, and you're focusing straight ahead and your vision's directed elsewhere. So it sort of increases the sensory mismatch, which is causing the sickness in the first place, because you are sort of dead, you're looking at a fixed point and you've got no visual information to try and help, you know, allay the brain's concerns. So yeah, that would make perfect sense.
So I think a lot of people outgrow motion sickness. And is that because your brain over time adjusts to the mixed message that it's getting when the vehicle is moving, but your body is staying still?
That's probably what's happening. Yeah. It's children are generally tend to be more prone to things like which are technically the brain getting things wrong. Things like sleepwalking. Children are far more prone to sleepwalking and things like that, and motion sickness. It's because their brains are still developing. They're still being shored up. They're still being refined. They're still forming all the connections they will need for the rest of their lives. And no, this means the systems aren't so efficient yet. So gradually and over time, they will, you know, they'll sort of lose the excessive parts. They'll refine the more useful components, and as a result, like the more, well, the less helpful things the brain does will sort of be slowly fading away, because the brain becomes a bit more focused and a bit more refined and efficient over time as we age.
So, how much is intelligence based on having a good memory? Like, if you have a hard time remembering things you've learned, then you can't build on those things. You can't use those things to synthesize, you know, an analysis of a text or politics or whatever. So are memory and intelligence intertwined and dependent on each other?
Yes, to a certain extent. A lot of psychologists differentiate between two types of intelligence. There's crystallized intelligence, which is like things you remember, things you've learned, and the information you have access to. So someone on a quiz show, for example, would be, you know, someone who's a champion of a quiz show, they would have very high crystallized intelligence, because they can just remember all this information, all these facts, and recall them at a moment's notice as and when they need to. So that's a very high crystallized intelligence. But that's not the only element of intelligence. It's also something we call fluid intelligence. And that's the ability to apply the information, the ability to work with it, the ability to process it. So if you see Sherlock Holmes, like, he's presented with three different things, and you go, they put these things together, they show that the killer was there at midnight and he had a brown dog, and that's more like fluid intelligence, because taking abstract information and processing it and working with it and applying it to the situation in front of you. So crystallized intelligence is like the information you have. Fluid intelligence would be your ability to use that information and extrapolate from it and to apply it in real-world situations. So the two are quite different in many ways. Like, fluid intelligence, a lot of research suggests that declines as we get older, just because our brains just age and become slightly less efficient over time with just general wear and tear. Whereas crystallized intelligence doesn't seem to have any ceiling on it. It just keeps expanding as we get older, assuming, of course, our brains still keep working as they should, and no neurodegeneration occurs.
I thought it was the other way around, that your ability to synthesize things does not decrease with age, but your ability to just kind of like memorize things and retrieve facts does.
A lot of people sort of claim that, yes, but a lot of the research suggests that it's actually the other way around, in that you can, I think it's more a case of you can't stop remembering things. Like, you don't reach the age 65 and then suddenly don't remember anything from that point on, because obviously that's not what happens, unless you have some sort of serious disorder, of course. But anyway, you can carry on building up information over time. You can, when you're 8 years old, you remember what happened yesterday or the day before, and you remember where to go, and you remember your appointments. So you can still build on the crystallized intelligence. It's just that the parts which process the information tend to get a bit rusty. So that according to the science, that's one argument anyway. But as I say in the book a lot, with most neuroscience claims and studies, you'll find another one which says the opposite pretty easily, because it's a very confusing organ.
Do you think of yourself as having a good memory?
I think I would say that I do have a good memory, but not for everything. Because the brain does seem to have a tendency to specialise or to have preferences for the things it likes to remember and likes to process. Some people are better at maths, some people are better at music and things. Whereas I, see, like I said, I have a good memory for episodes of The Simpsons or jokes that I've heard or people I've met recently and like anecdotes, but things like household organisation and bills to pay, I tend to have a rather poor memory for these things, as my wife will constantly tell me. So, yeah, I have a good memory in some ways and not in others.
So you write a blog for The Guardian, mm-hmm, called Brain Flapping.
Yeah.
What's the most commented on post that you've written?
This, it came as a surprise for the first time, but it shouldn't have in hindsight. I've written about a lot of things, like trying to deal with some controversial subjects like transgender issues, that was quite a hot button one, and immigration, whether it's good or bad, and same-sex marriage got a lot of responses. But the most controversial post I did, in terms of the most angry comments I got, was whether or not you should put milk in your tea before the water or after. that is the most British thing you'll ever hear, I know, but that is like, that was the most, even my parents got involved with that one, which they never normally do. So
wait, so what was your argument?
Well, there's a study which says you should put milk in first, but that actually only applies to if you use it from a teapot in a sort of bone china cup, because obviously it takes the heat off the tea so the cup doesn't fracture. But if you use a mug, then it's got a different process, and it went down into the chemistry of it, and it came down to the fact that you should put it first or last. It depends on how you like it, because it's all about taste perception and the ritual and the psychology behind it. But that diplomatic cop-out wasn't enough for some people. They decided that I should hear in no uncertain terms how wrong I was.
So which do you do?
I put milk in second, actually. But I might actually be kicked out of the country for this, but I can't tell either way, and that's not something a British person wants to hear. But I'm not actually fussed either way. I can take it both ways.
Nice to know that tea is clickbait in England.
Very much so.
Dean Burnett, thank you so much for talking with us.
No problem at all. Thank you very much for having me, Terry.
Dean Burnett is the author of the book Idiot Brain, What Your Head is Really Up To. He writes the science blog Brain Flapping for the British newspaper The Guardian. After we take a short break, we'll hear from comic Ali Wong, whose comedy special is frank and funny on subjects ranging from being Asian American to her sex life and being pregnant. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumosity, brain training with games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. From scientists and game designers exploring new ways to research human cognition. Learn more at lumosity.com. And from Angie's List. For 20 years, Angie's List has striven to provide consumers with transparency about local services. Online reviews and hiring tools are at angieslist.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, comedian Ali Wong, released her first comedy special in May on Netflix. Mark Maron called it, quote, the most honest, rawest, funniest special I've seen in years, unquote. In Wong's comedy special, called Baby Cobra, she talks about being Asian American, stereotypes, interracial dating, and prejudice within the Asian American community. She's also very frank and funny when talking about her sex life, what it was like to have her body transformed by pregnancy, and having had a miscarriage. When she recorded her comedy special, she was 7.5 months pregnant. She's since had her daughter and is trying to make the demands of motherhood and stand-up comedy compatible. It was just announced that she will be part of the Funny or Die Oddball Comedy Festival this fall. She spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. They started with a clip from Baby Cobra.
So, I don't know if you guys can tell, but I am 7.5 months pregnant. Yeah. It's very rare and unusual to see a female comic perform pregnant because female comics don't get pregnant. Just try to think of one. I dare you. There's none of them. Once they do get pregnant, they generally disappear. That's not the case with male comics. Once they have a baby, they'll get up on stage a week afterwards and they'll be like, guys, I just had this baby. That baby's a little piece of it's so annoying and boring. And all these other dads in the audience are like, that's hilarious. I identify. And their fame just swells because they become this relatable family funny man all of a sudden. Meanwhile, the mom is at home chapping her nipples, feeding the baby. She's busy.
That's a scene from Baby Cobra. Ali Wong, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So I find your performance, the physicality of your performance in this special, so empowered. You took this thing, pregnancy, that's usually thought of as making women vulnerable or weak, and you turn that idea on its head. It also blows the theory of, you know, are women funny kind of out of the water because, you know, here's a woman being as womanly as she can possibly be. And, you know, the special is so funny. Can you talk about choosing to do the special while 7.5 months pregnant?
Yeah, I had originally, I've been doing comedy now for, I think, 11 years. And for the past 4 years, people have come to me and been like, when are you going to do a special? When are you going to do a special? And I wasn't ready yet. I didn't feel like I was ready. And then finally, when I got pregnant the first time around, I was like, okay, I have to do it now, because if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it, because if I have a kid, who knows I'm going to feel with all the hormones and everything, and I might just stop. And then I had a miscarriage, and then I was depressed, and I was like, forget it. We're not going to do it. And then I got pregnant again, and I was like, okay, we got to do it now, because I'm never going to do it. I had that feeling again where I was like, I was panicked, and I had all this anxiety about how the baby would change my career. And I wanted, you know, to associate her with changing it for the better. And she absolutely has. So it worked in that sense. But it was more a personal decision than it was like, I think this is going to be really funny if people see me pregnant on stage.
In that clip that we just heard, you sort of bring up the double standard that happens, that, you know, male comedians can sort of instantly come back. But for female comedians, it's a different story if you get pregnant or if you have kids. Is that something that you were scared of? Were you scared that it would mean, like in you say in the clip, that you might disappear like other female comedians?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've seen many female comics that a lot of people haven't heard of who are so funny. And I saw them come up and they were working so hard. And then all of a sudden they had a baby and they just got tied up in motherhood. And eventually they kind of just stopped doing stand up. And I thought it was such a shame, you know. But I mean, even now when I go out, people are like, what are you doing here? Didn't you just have a baby? But people never ask, like a male comic when he's out a week later, like, oh my God, you are so irresponsible. What are you doing out? Who's taking care of the baby? She's 6 months old now, but when I first started going out, people couldn't believe that I was out and about already. The other thing with stand-up is that it's kind of like keeping in shape, you know, like lifting weights. Like if you skip a week, you really revert, you get worse. It's an art form where you have to really go up every single night. And it's not very forgiving if you take a break. So in giving birth, I mean, I knew that I would have to take a break after I had a baby. I just didn't know that it would be like 6 weeks long. And taking a 6 week break was a very big deal for me. I've never taken that long of a break from stand up other than my honeymoon, which was 14 days long.
Did you really have you mentioned this in the special. Did you really have friends who told you to not have a kid because it might ruin your career?
I did. Yeah, I did have some female stand-up friends who, they didn't tell me to not have a kid, but they were asking questions about why and, you know, to think about really what would happen to me as a stand-up if I had a kid. But I have to say that, you know, what was really encouraging was you know, I had a talk with Chris Rock about getting married and having kids. And I expressed to him that I was really anxious about it and I was really worried about how it would affect my career. And he said to me, you know what, Allie, I think that if you do get married and have kids, that you will actually have a real shot at being truly famous. And I'm talking about the kind of famous where your mother knows who you are. Not my own mother, but like a mother, you know, like a household name. And he said, because most of America is married and has kids. And that really changed my perspective, you know, because then it was kind of the beginning of me thinking about how to use my marriage and my pregnancy as not a source of downfall and weakness, but instead as a source of power and relatability.
Have you found already that your comedy has changed since having a baby?
Yeah. I mean, I'm much more excited about the material, the stuff I've been doing since the special, since the baby was born. I'm so much more excited about that. Also because, I mean, I'm so sick of all the material that I did in Baby Cobra. And I was so done with it. But yeah, I mean, it's so crazy to connect to this whole population now of parents and talk about breastfeeding and mommy groups and preschool searches and, you know, having a take on that, I think it's been really wonderful.
Can you give us an example of something you're working on right now that's kind of new in the
I
last
could
six
go
months?
On and on about breastfeeding. I mean, I could, like, I thought it was supposed to be like this beautiful bonding ceremony where I would feel like I was sitting on a lily pad in a meadow and bunnies would gather at my feet while the Fat Hawaiian Man version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow would play. But really, it's like this savage ritual that just reminds you that all of us, we're nothing but mammals. We ain't special, you know? I mean, when she gets hungry, my baby girl, she yanks my nipple back and forth like that bear effing up Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant. It's frightening. I mean, and just like the lactation consultant, all of these things surrounding it. I mean, when you become a mother, it's like you just seek aid from so many white hippie witches. Doulas, lactation consultants, you know, all these placenta encapsulation people, all these white hippie witches who you pay like $500, white hippie lady, $500, Mrs. Sorcerer. Yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about it. Some of it funny, some of it extremely tragic and not so funny. Pumping's a whole thing. You have to get naked at work, all that stuff, you know, so.
Well, I think, and it relates to your other comedy because your other comedy is kind of talking about, like, sex and your body in a way that a lot of people can relate to, but people don't talk about that much in public. So all this breastfeeding stuff, I think a lot of people who don't have kids yet don't know any of this stuff. And then it's kind of like trial by fire. Like all of a sudden you need to know all these things.
Yeah. And it's raw and it's dirty
too.
You know, like one of my managers was like not that excited about me talking about motherhood. And he's like, I don't know, Allie, you know, it's not as hardcore as the stuff you used to do. And I was like, well, I think having a baby sliced out of you is pretty hardcore.
I'm wondering if being pregnant and giving birth has changed your feelings about your body and sex at all. I mean, you talk about, in the special, you talk a lot about it, but it was sort of before you had the baby. Has your thinking about those things changed since having the baby?
Yeah. I mean, when you give birth to a baby, your body, like, disintegrates. It continues to disintegrate. That's why women need maternity leave. It's not to bond with the baby. You need to, like, heal your body. So for example, when I was breastfeeding and I got a clogged duct, that's, you know, when you get like a kidney stone, that's when you get like a traffic jam on the 405 in your breast and you have to call a white hippie witch, a lactation consultant to come over to your house. A lactation consultant is a white hippie witch that you pay like $200 to behave like the wolf from Pulp Fiction. He tells you to gather like a bowl of hot water and a towel and a fresh diaper, telling you to gather all this stuff. And she had me on my hands and knees, dipping my boob in and out of a bowl of hot water and then punching my breasts with a fist. And I was like, this is ridiculous. I mean, I can't be doing this at work, you know? And then my body, like, how is my husband supposed to see me as a sexual being anymore when, you know, he sees all this going on? So, yes, in other words, my perspective has changed about my body and sex a lot. It can't help but change, because your body has gone through the most drastic transformation in the world.
Did that work? Did the dipping in the water and then the punching
work?
Oh,
yeah, it worked. Yeah. I mean, I'm like an expert now on how to unclog a duck. Now I'm the wolf from Pulp Fiction, and now my friends will call me.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with comic Ali Wong. Her comedy special, Baby Cobra, is on Netflix. They'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And from Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting Salzburg Global Seminar, which works to challenge current and future leaders to solve issues of global concern. Learn more at salzburgglobal.org.
This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with comic Ali Wong. Her comedy special, Baby Cobra, is on Netflix.
Now, you're married to an Asian-American man, and you talk about dating and the interracial and interethnic politics of who Asian-American women date. You talk about that in your special and in your comedy. I'm going to play a clip from the special. Here you are talking about it, about being married to someone else who is also Asian-American.
I think that for marriage, it can be nice to be with somebody of your own race. The advantage is that you get to go home and be racist together. You get to say whatever you like. You don't gotta explain. My husband, half Filipino, half Japanese. I'm half Chinese and half Vietnamese, and we spend 100% of our time on Korean people. It's amazing.
That's a clip from Baby Cobra. I will say that first and foremost, your special is just incredibly funny. But, you know, you kind of touch on these larger issues here that aren't always talked about, you know, like this kind of issue of racism in the Asian American community. And it's like, that's the kind of stuff that maybe gets talked about in the community, but they aren't talked about much in public. It's like dirty laundry airing. Do you think about that before putting it into your stand-up?
I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not really trying to make a statement with any of my stand-up. My goal is really to just make people laugh with integrity, like with something that I still find funny. So, you know, with that joke, I was surprised that it works so well, because I didn't think that, I just didn't know if other people who weren't Asian American could maybe identify with. But, like, you know, I mean, Latino people can certainly identify, because, you know, Asian American is this crazy, like, umbrella term that encapsulates, like, so many different cultures, you know, that are so different. And same thing with Latino, like that's everybody in like Central America, South America, the Dominican Republic. It's like very, it's extremely diverse. So of course there's going to be like interracial, like racism and stuff. And it's funny, you know, so I wasn't trying to like bring inter-Asian racism to
the forefront,
light to the mainstream. That was not my agenda. It was just like, oh, this is funny. This works.
Well, soon after this clip that we played, you say that you're half Chinese and half Vietnamese, and your husband's half Japanese and half Filipino. And then could you just say what your next joke about that, which I think is
oh,
so
right.
Funny.
So we're both half fancy Asian and half jungle Asian.
Which to me, as a Filipino American woman with, yeah, you know, a little bit of other
you're
stuff in there too.
You're party Asian. Yeah. Yeah, you're DJ Asian.
I'm singing dance Asian. but I just laughed and laughed because I hadn't really ever heard of it, heard it put that way.
Yeah, because there's like a real divide. I mean, like you look at, my husband and I went to Japan for our honeymoon, and you look at like the presentation of the food, and it's ridiculous. You know, it looks like a Mondrian painting or something like this. Everything looks like a bunch of little Hello Kitty erasers when you eat like a little bento box in Japan. It's so precise and beautiful and processed and neat. And then, you know, like some of my Japanese American friends will see me going to town on a bowl of pig's feet and they'll be like, oh my God, you jungle Asian. And it's just like, we're the same. Like, I'm not supposed to feel bad about what I'm eating in front of you guys, but I do, because it's different, you know? But like with my husband, I do really appreciate the fact that even though we're like different kinds of Asian, there is like a cultural shorthand between us, and I don't have to explain anything. You know, I've dated guys before who weren't Asian American, and it frustrated me when I would have to defend why beans belong in a dessert. You know, like they thought it was so weird, or like when I'd take them out to a meal, like a dim sum or something, and they'd be like, what is that? What is that? Why is that not a sandwich? And I was like, just eat the food. I did not drive like an hour to Monterey Park to become a dim sum teacher.
Now, another aspect of your special that's getting a lot of coverage is the fact that you tell this joke about having a miscarriage. I think you've said that you tried the joke out a bunch of times before figuring out whether or not to include it in the special. Did you have to get to a certain point before joking about it? Did you have to process it first, or was that something you kind of did right away?
Before deciding to do it, I started talking about my miscarriage right away. Like, I think the day after it happened, I think I got up on stage and started talking about it, and it was not going very well, and it did not go well for a while. And Lori Kilmartin, who is also a very funny stand-up comic, who's a mom as well, and she writes for Conan, had told me, I think that people need to know that you're okay in order for that joke to work. Because she was like, those jokes are really funny, but people, I think, need to just feel like you're okay. And whether it was like my attitude that changed, where maybe I became more at peace and okay with it, or if it was the fact that people could see that I was pregnant and maybe that's how they defined being okay, pregnant again. But after a while, it did just start to work. But I really kept persisting with it because I did feel like really passionate about talking about it.
Yeah, the thing about miscarriages is they're very common, but you wouldn't know that because people don't often talk about it. Like I personally had a miscarriage, and I felt I didn't know how many people had them until I told people. Then you sort of
right.
Then people start talking about it. And maybe it's because there's a little bit of guilt involved, even though you don't really do anything to get a miscarriage, but it's you sort of kind of blame your body
you
for
feel
not
that.
Doing it. Yeah. Is that
right.
Did you experience that yourself?
Of course. You know, I thought to myself, is it because I did slip and I did eat that piece of raw cucumber? Is it because I did a twist in yoga during the first trimester when I didn't know that I was pregnant? Is it because, you know, I walked by these people who were smoking? There was all sorts of things. Is it because, you know, of karma? Is it because I was mean to this person in first grade and pushed them when I shouldn't have? I mean, yeah, there's all sorts of blame that I think women put on themselves. It's very easy to do that. But, you know, even now, just hearing you, someone who I'm talking to, had a miscarriage, you know, I feel for you. And at the same time, I am so grateful that you told me that. And it makes me feel so comforted to know that you had one too, you know? I mean, it's one thing to hear the statistic and to hear that it's very common. And it's another to put a face and a voice to another person who has had a miscarriage as well, you know?
Right.
So, again, like I said, I don't like to make statements in comedy. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm here to make people laugh. But for that, you know, one, I Yeah, I mean, so she had heard, you know, about all the women who had had it growing up, and she has, like, that very healthy attitude of, like, it's very common and it's not your fault.
We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with comic Ali Wong. Her comedy special, Baby Cobra, is on Netflix. They'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with comic Ali Wong. Her comedy special, Baby Cobra, is on Netflix.
I want to play another clip from the special. You talk about hoarding and about yes. helping your mom clean out her house.
I have a hoarding problem, which I'm hoping is the center of all of my other problems. I'm hoping if the hoarding goes away, the HPV will also disappear. I have a hoarding problem because my mom is from a third world country. And she taught me that you can never throw away anything because you never know when a dictator's gonna overtake the country and snatch all your wealth. So you better hold on to that retainer from the third grade because it might come in handy as a shovel when you're busy stuffing gold up your and running away from the communists.
That's a clip from Baby Cobra. Was that something that you actually had to do? Did you have to go through stuff in your mom's house?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough with immigrant parents because they're from a different time. You know, they were from like a time where things were built to last, and you know, her worst nightmare is having to buy something again or needing something and then having had it and thrown it away and it going to waste.
Yeah, I read that your dad sort of came from very modest beginnings and sort of had to work
his way. Yeah, my dad grew up with straight up no running water. He slept in a twin bed with his two sisters and his mom, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory style, like feet at the head, alternating. And then I think his dad slept on like a bed of newspapers on a floor in their apartment. All the investment was in him. My aunts, his two sisters, didn't get to go to college because my grandparents could only afford for one kid to go to college, and that was my dad. And I'm so amazed still at how he had all that pressure on him and just took it in stride and just, like, killed it, you know? He became a doctor, and I'm so proud of him still for doing that. It's really hard for people to understand, like, what a quirky person my dad was, and also he could have cared less about what other people thought about him. I mean, if he had to fart, he would do it at the library, at the opera. Like, the quieter, the better. And it used to embarrass me so much, but it also made me laugh really hard every single time he did it. And so at the same time, he was also, like, very smart, you know? He was, like, really into poetry, and he was an extremely good painter. And so he kind of had like this highbrow, lowbrow thing going on that, you know, really influenced me.
So are you still performing as much stand-up as you did before having the baby?
I don't do it as much. Maybe I just do it like, I would say, a fifth less than when she was inside of me. because it's pretty painful at night sometimes to not put my daughter to bed.
Right.
You know, because it's really sweet when they go to bed and you read them the book and they're cooing and they might laugh or something. And it's kind of a bummer to miss them when they're going to bed. But I try to book shows after she falls asleep.
Mm-hmm.
What's nice is that because of the special now, because bookers and people who put on shows in LA have known me for a while, I can ask them and I can request to go up later and have that request granted. But I think for people who are starting out, it's much harder to make motherhood and comedy work because those requests might not get granted.
Well, Ali Wong, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Ali Wong spoke with Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado. Wong's stand-up comedy special, Baby Cobra, is on Netflix. She's performing stand-up over the summer, and in the fall will be part of Funny or Die's Oddball Comedy Festival. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote the definitive book about the O.J. Simpson trial. He has a new book about Patricia Hearst, the newspaper heiress who in 1974 was kidnapped by the incoherent armed radical group the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army. We'll talk about Hearst's kidnapping and trial and where it fit in the culture, politics, and media of the 70s. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Thea Chaloner. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Whole Foods Market, where yellow signs identify featured items throughout stores each week, from grass-fed burgers to gluten-free buns. Whole Foods Market, committed to quality standards and planet-friendly practices. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, working with states to develop data-driven, nonpartisan solutions for complex issues. Learn more at pewtrusts.org.